For those people who are online, we are starting John Sower's session imminently. Please be ready.
The title of this talk is Sharing and Initiating On. Basically, this evolved from some discussions that were going on Ontolog Forum during the past couple of weeks, starting from about the middle of February until about now. And these all have to do with the issues about what do we represent, how do we represent it, and how do we relate our ontologies to everything else in the computer systems. How do we relate it not just to the semantic web, but to our databases, to our programming languages, and to all the methodologies that people have accumulated over the years for developing programs and software and databases and interrelating them. And this is one of the themes that I have been very disappointed about the semantic web, and I have expressed my disappointment at many times. I think the idea is excellent, but the point is that every website out there, every commercial website, has typically had a relational database at the heart of it. And if you want to extend the semantics of the traditional web, what you must do is integrate your semantics with the semantics of the websites that are already out there. If they've got a relational database, you must have some method of integrating your new technology with it. Now, by the way, I am not in favor of traditional database technology as it is, because a lot of it has evolved in very quirky kinds of ways, and SQL was never the language that I would have preferred. And as a matter of fact, Ted Kott himself, when he saw Prolog, he said, "I wish I had invented that." And there is a notation for databases called Datalog, which, by the way, happens to use a Prolog-like notation. And I think that's a far better foundation for processing relational databases than SQL. On the other hand, SQL as it exists is something that exists, and we must live with it. Therefore, we've got to support it, among everything else. And my basic position is that if it exists out there and people use it and their business depends on it, we must support it. We must have migration paths from the past to the future. And my greatest complaint about the semantic web is that they did not consider the migration paths from all of the software that was being developed and had been used for many years beforehand, and they did not integrate the semantics of the semantic web with what was there. I'm all in favor of adapting new things, and description logics I consider is a very fine subset of logic, and as a matter of fact, it includes Aristotle's syllogisms as a subset, and Aristotle's syllogisms are an excellent foundation for describing an important part of logic, but there's a lot more to logic than just syllogisms. The first slide talks about the foundations for interoperability, and in the report that I've been writing that goes with it, it goes into a little bit more detail about these issues. And the point is that any two programs that interoperate must agree on syntax, semantics, and pragmatics of the data and the language and whatever else they're interchanging. But and the formal ontologies are metadata about those things and events and properties and people that are involved.
John, by pragmatics, you mean the linguistic interpretation?
By syntax, semantics, and pragmatics, I mean everything there is to meaning. By syntax, the patterns of what you write, of how you put your symbols together. By semantics, I mean the relationships between the symbols and something outside the language. So if it's a language about mathematics, the symbols in your notation must relate to numbers and geometrical figures and whatever you're talking about. If it's a language about the world, the symbols must relate to the world. And then pragmatics is what do you do with it? What is the intention? What is the purpose? What are the what does all this stuff come to be written for? Why do you write this stuff? Why do you use it? On the essential answer to pragmatics is why. Why on earth did you write this in this particular language? So semantics just says, here is how these symbols relate to the world. But pragmatics answers the questions of why on earth you want to refer to those things in that way and for what purpose. And that's what gets you to the motivation and eventually the actions and everything else. Now, as a typical example, I gave this little clip from some documentation. This came out of some actual stuff that was written by programmers. And as you notice, they use a mixture of English with computer jargon and very, very specialized kinds of things. And in the report that I was writing along with this, I just picked out one little phrase like 32- loss on unbilled. Now, if you just look at that, the 32 is an extremely specialized use of the integer 32. And it's just used as a notation for a code that has some syntax of two-digit integer, but it has a semantics that relates to something that is being used and shared, and the particular thing here is some phrase there that says loss on unbilled. And if you look at the word loss, well, that could be all kinds of things, but in this case, it has to deal with financial transactions, and so this gets into the gains and losses in a business enterprise. And when you talk about unbilled, there you're talking about billing and accounts receivable and all of those issues. And if you try to do an ontology for this, you end up getting to an ontology of businesses, bookkeeping, money, and just an incredible amount of interrelated concepts that have to be built into this. And if we are going to design systems for interoperability, we are going to need a lot of these kinds of things already predefined and packaged, and we need a lot of guidelines. We need a lot of material that people can use and reuse in a variety of different ways. So these are the kinds of things we are going to have to deal with. Yes.
Could you say a little more about what you think, what do you mean by interoperability?
Okay. Two different systems independently developed are plugged together so that output from one is going to be working, that they're either going to share common data or they're going to send data to one another for some purpose. And you want them to be able to work together so that they accomplish their goals, whatever they are, whatever the pragmatics are, of the whatever the intentionality, the purposes of the designers and developers, and they've got to work together.
Does that work together mean it's 100% perfect or sufficient?
It's sufficient for the task.
Okay.
And you will never have two independently developed programs, or in fact, two independent people who are 100% interoperable on every last thing. Yes. Yes, absolutely. And in fact, I would include the whole tradition that goes back long before computers. They had S&P department, systems and procedures department. And by procedures, they meant tasks that human beings did. And the systems were whole clerk messes of clerks and secretaries and managers and people interacting, passing messages and data and things among them. And those are your systems and procedures things. And when when punch card equipment came along, they moved them to punch cards. And then when the computers came along, they moved it to computers. But the systems have to include everything. I just want to say everything. All of these are issues, and I don't want to exclude anything. I want to include everything, and one of the things that when Leo was talking about his courses and he was emphasizing the semantic web, I said, you know, I like the semantic web, except the fact that it's so provincial, and it's just such a tiny part of the whole problem, and they seem to think that the World Wide Web is somehow big. Of course it's big, but the world is even bigger, and all they have is a tiny part of it. And I would say you've got to include everything, every computer system that any, and also the human systems have to be incorporated in this. And you're not going to represent all that in RDF and OWL. Okay. These are the some of the terms that I wanted to talk about. Ontology is a study of what exists. That is the philosophical department. And then when you want to convert that into something that runs on a computer, you're going to have to translate it into something very detailed and precise in such a way that you can map it into computable terms. The terminologies, those things have existed for years, and standardized terminologies started with Linnaeus in classifying the biological terms about 300 years ago. And since then, you've been getting terminologies for every field. Every field of science, engineering, business, and the arts has terminologies. All of these are extremely important, and they must be accommodated. They're usually rather technical terms specialized for that field. The lexical resources are the kinds of resources that people have, the dictionaries, the thesauruses, the grammars, and all the other kinds of stuff that people use and that linguists develop and that are used for theories of linguistics. All of those are extremely important, but they are not formal ontologies. And unfortunately, people tend to confuse these three things. Yes.
John, is a terminology a lexical resource?
Yes, but I would say it's a specialized kind of lexical resource. It's the lexical resources for a particular branch of science. So, for example, the chemists have had their terminologies for all of the molecules of organic, inorganic and organic chemistry, all of the elements. They've been having those things for over a century for that. And then the medical terminology, that's been, you've got more than half a century of those. They've been classifying those very, very formally. And you can say that they are extensions of WordNet for practical purposes, so you can mix them with WordNet, but there's an enormous amount of those. The point, though, is that the terminologies usually are somewhat more precise than what you get in a dictionary because they are narrowed down to a single word sense, but they are not really as precise as a formal ontology. And the point that I also wanted to make is that people have been talking about aligning their ontologies for years. And in fact, long before they were aligning ontologies, they were aligning databases. And the problem there is that it's fine to say that this table, this column, and this table of one database corresponds to this column of another database, but you really have to look at the formal definitions, and most of these people don't really align those definitions.
I'm not trying to be too obnoxious here, but you just talked about but it just occurred to me, you used the phrase a precise ontology. Could I ask you to explain the metric for precise there?
Okay. It's something that you can program on a computer, and you can prove theorems with it. You can test it for consistency. You can translate it into an SQL query. Precise means precise with the same level of precision of a programming language, something that you can translate formally from one notation to another, and it works the same in both systems.
So that notion, that metric for precision, does not include the realm of the interpretation in natural language or in terms of humans.
When you get to, let me, that gets into my next issue, and let me get to this slide. The world is interface. And this was that book by Otto Ressler. And as I mentioned before, for those people that I had talked about this briefly earlier, and those people who weren't there, if you want to find out more about this thing, just type Rossler without the umlaut, O-R-S-S-L-E-R, and the word endophysics, and you'll find lots of stuff on Google. And you'll even find a copy of his book as available as a Google book. You'll find a book review about it and a lot of things. I'm not going to go into much detail at all about the book. However, what he does do is make a very important distinction that I'd like to carry through because it is extremely important for all of our discussions about what is precise and what isn't. And Rexler has three important terms: exophysics, endophysics, and interface. The exophysics, that has to do with all of the theories of physics. There's an enormous number of them, going from electromagnetism to Newtonian mechanics, quantum mechanics, all of those things that physicists talk about, fluid mechanics and solid-state physics and everything else. An enormous number of them, and most of the things that they talk about are really highly technical terms that you don't actually observe. Like, you never go around and walk into a room and observe entropy. But they talk about that all the time, and they define it in all sorts of ways. And you don't see atoms and molecules. You don't feel electromagnetic fields, except for the ones within the visible range or the infrared range. You don't really perceive these things, but they're all around us, and these theories talk about them in very precise terms. Now, the endophysics, that is what we all think about. And every one of us has a lot of built-in knowledge in our heads, well, not built-in, but we acquired it through our lives, of how the world works, how to get around the world, how to deal with it, how to move things around. We know a lot about physics just from the way we work. And each of us has a different way of thinking about it and talking about it. There may be a lot of commonalities, but really the commonalities between endophysics and exophysics are the interface. Those are the things that we actually observe, the objects that are within the range of human vision and our most of our friendly animals and some of our predator animals as well. Those are the level of precision that we really must deal with. That is the interface between those two. Yes, sir. Right. There is a lot that each of our internal views about the world are strongly influenced by what we learn from other people, including the physicists who talk about their exophysics. So, for example, Aristotelian physics dominated the way people thought about the world for thousands of years. And then today people are, then when Newton came around, they perfected some of those things. However, there are still an awful lot of people that never took a course in physics in their lifetime. They may have picked up a lot of words from it, but they really have a very vague term, a vague feeling for it. And if you look at, a baseball player or a basketball player who gets a three-pointer from halfway across the court, that person has an incredibly precise built-in feeling for how that ball can, what speed and trajectory does it need to get into that hoop. And that is a level of precision that is amazing. But that person is not capable of articulating that in any natural language, but that person has a feeling for how it works. And that's the same is true of the animals. They have a lot of feeling for that works. That's all those endophysics. Yeah.
Could you repeat questions, please?
Yes, so well, there's one question here right in here. We're getting one question, and then some from the outside.
As you started with the definition of an ontology in the previous slide, can exophysics, the way that you defined that, is it an ontology now?
Okay. When we get to the study of existence, the physicists, what scientists do very definitely impinges on existence, and if you really talk about what exists and all the properties that are it have, and you try to define them formally, you are going to get theories that really get down to the level of physics. If you really get very, very precise in spelling everything out, you really are going to define all of science as part of your ontology of what exists. However, the part that the philosophers usually classify as ontology is typically what is called metaphysics. It's sort of the kind of stuff that is common knowledge and to anybody that lives in the world. And so they're talking more at the level between the endophysics and the exophysics and they're trying to relate those things. So what the philosophers talk about ontology, they sort of are trying to straddle the interface between the two, whereas the physicists who are trying to perfect their theories really get into exophysics. Now, I wanted to use this point about Otto Rechler's stuff as a stimulus for some of the further discussion. And what I would really recommend is that you go to Google, read his book, buy his book, read the reviews about it or some of the articles, because I would rather not try to explicate all of these things. I'm just saying that this is a useful triad for distinguishing it. We had another question. Was there some questions from the online? Yes, online questions. Can we have that?
Yes.
Before you start, would other online people please sign on to the chat board, and there's a hand button, raise your hand, and we can queue up, and at least we will know who's trying to ask a question. Don't worry. Please identify yourself and start your remarks.
Right, it's Mike Bennett here. I was actually firstly just asking whether questions could be repeated, because the ones from the far end of the room are so quiet that one can't even tell that anybody is speaking. But I did have a question slightly earlier, which I think is still relevant, on the question of precision and the precision of lexical resources versus ontology. I was just wondering, Dr. Sower, if another way of looking at it, which might relate to the Rosler work, is how the meaning of something is grounded. So in a lexical resource, you know, or a precise terminology, I haven't got the right slide in front of me now, the precise terminology or whatever still appeals to a human reader, so that the meaning is grounded in the mind of a human being, whereas in an ontology, the meaning is defined within some theory of meaning that lives within that ontology. And I wonder whether that makes sense of two ways in which meaning is grounded, and is that really what you're saying in a different way in terms of extraphysics and endophysics?
Well, yes, there are different criteria for the level of precision in scientific theories and formal ontologies than in sort of casual everyday use of language. On the other hand, really all of our experience is grounded in that interface level. So everything that we learn from the time we've been children all the way up comes from experience, from what we experience in our everyday lives, and also from what's communicated to us by our colleagues and teachers.
Yeah, that's heavy in learning within the individual human or animal brain, right?
Right. And that learning, a very, very large part, an enormous part, comes from the interfaces that we have with the world. And at the moment, I don't want to really get into a theory of meaning and everything that has to do with the philosophy of science and the philosophy of physics and the philosophy of everything else. Those are important issues, but for the moment, I'd rather just not go into all that detail. Okay. Any other questions? Comments?
Yeah, Gary Berkowitz. It seems to me that maybe the point that you're making here is about the interface, the importance of the interface. So, I mean, we're familiar with the reality of the exophysics and the conceptual level of the endophysics, and this seems like a slightly different point about the interface. Is it the case that you're trying to, as you move forward, you're trying to talk about how to articulate the interface in a more formal and richer way?
Well, one of the things that I'm trying to do is to emphasize the point that Rechler was mentioning, and that is the consistency with the phenomena at the interface is the ultimate criterion of accuracy for both exophysics and endophysics. In other words, what we experience in our everyday lives, that is the foundation for physics. Now, the physicist will be developing all kinds of more precise instruments for measurement and everything else, but ultimately, every step of the way in the evolution of physics and all the sciences has been based on what people actually see and feel in their everyday lives. And the even our instruments, we say, well, okay, we can see actual molecules and atoms when we go using some of these electron microscopes. On the other hand, it's not true. We don't really see them with the electron microscopes. What we see is a TV screen connected to some equipment that is connected to other equipment that is connected to other equipment that translates all kinds of very tiny impulses into an image on a TV screen. So when we say we see it, we really see it through highly indirect mechanisms which are built up from bootstrapping from ultimately that interface of what we see with our own eyes and ears and feelings.
But they are built up in the endophysics world. In other words, the concepts that we have direct some of our interpretation and
everything we know is in our minds, which is endophysics. And then we talk with one another to try to calibrate, and our teachers teach us the common knowledge that has been acquired over the centuries, and so that we can calibrate our vocabulary, that we can use words in such ways that we can communicate. So in other words, the interoperability does depend on agreements about these things, at least with the level of accuracy of the ordinary dictionaries that we use, things like WordNet. But if we want to get formal accuracy, we need to go much deeper. Yes?
Well, as a philosopher, I don't know. There are so many points here to talk about that. The only thing I want to mention is that, at least the remark, the philosophers are mainly interested in the middle layer, or, you know, not in the small particles. I don't think that's really, I mean, that you can't just say that. I mean, physicalists would think what is real about reality are the atomic particles. And but we really should, I think this is philosophy of science. This really leads us here to philosophy of science.
Yes.
And a lot of things here are things which could have been discussed, like the Vienna Circle or Quine's reaction to it. So we really should, if we want to talk about ontology, we probably should not go further into that.
Exactly. I didn't want to spend more than 2 minutes on this slide.
Okay.
And if you're really interested, study philosophy of science, study psychology of perception, study the interactions and relations between them. Those are extremely important fields. I'm not going to that's beyond the scope of what we can cover today. Let's just go through. Okay. The only point I want to make is that interface level, that's where we can relate our ontologies to language. That's the area where we have to relate. And also, if we have theories, detailed theories of science that disagree with one another, they may use all sorts of variables that are very indirectly related to what's perceptible. However, the only thing that we can do to relate our things, we can relate independent theories at the level of the interface, at the perceptible interface. Okay. Now, here's a... Yes?
So, a thought about the interface. Increasingly, the things that we deal with are not in the physical world. They're concepts that we've made up. Processes, policies, services, whatever you want to call them. And in fact, they exist by virtue of their specification.
Yes.
And as the field has grown, and as our models have grown, that's become, in fact, the bulk of it for a lot of applications. So in that case, there is no physical reality really there to share, to interface with. But it's a hugely important domain.
There's extreme levels of meta levels upon meta levels upon meta levels, which are all very important. And yes, I certainly agree with that. All I wanted to do is to talk about, use this distinction as a basis for talking about how we can reconcile some ontologies. Now, when we get to methodologies of how we're going to develop software, that gets into a completely different topic, and I wanted to talk about those, and I left that for the end. But the methodologies of methods for developing... At the bottom level, we're talking about the world. we want our computers to help us deal with things in the world. Among the things, there are these various kinds of bookkeeping methods that have been developed since the time of the Italian Renaissance and included in our computer systems. Then there's also methodologies for developing stuff. These are extremely important. Extremely, extremely, extremely important. They're so important, I won't talk about them. Okay? I'm not throwing them away. I'm saying I at least want to talk about something that we can talk about today. And those other ones, that's another topic for another topic. But at least I'm not denying what you're saying. I'm saying it's very important, but let's get on with this. Okay. Now, methods of reasoning. Now, here's something that Michael got upset about, and so I would like to... Oh, it's the next one. Oh, too bad. Okay, let's get to this one. The methods of reasoning, the point that I'm saying is that theorem proving is only one of many ways of using logic. And one of the things that people often say is that first-order logic is inefficient. But that is true if you want to use unrestricted first-order logic to prove theorems. On the other hand, the most widespread use of first-order logic for computer systems is in databases. And the tables of a relational database or the networks of an object-oriented database are isomorphic to a Tarski-style model. Now, for those of you who have never studied model theory and Tarski and never heard of Tarski, that's a whole area of logic that is used to represent the semantics of a formal system. And Alfred Tarski was a logician who grew up in Poland and migrated to the U.S. around in the 1930s, and he developed a system for showing how you can verify that a particular statement in logic happens to be true of a particular model. And the models that he defined were sets of relations, sets of individuals, and relations about those individuals. And those things can be represented very nicely, at least for the finite ones, can be represented very nicely in the tables of a relational database or in the networks of the semantic web or the networks of an object-oriented database. And every query processing is a request to take a particular statement in logic and verify whether or not it is true of that database. And the method that the method of verification happens to be isomorphic to what Tarski did for logic. The tables of a relational database correspond to the relations in logic, and the query in a SQL query corresponds to a statement in first-order logic, and those queries can be tested in polynomial time at worst, and in sometimes in linear or even logarithmic time. Constraint checking is another use of first-order logic, also stated in a where clause of an SQL statement. And for each database update, each constraint is evaluated, must be evaluated to be true before the update is permitted. Now, Robbie, you have another comment? Well, when we get to classical first-order logic, you have only two truth values, true and false. When we get to a relational database or an object-oriented database, we have the problems of, do we have a closed world or an open world? If you have a closed world assumption, that means that you have only two possibilities, true or false. If you have an open world, then there can be some things that are true, some things that are false, and then you can have a gray area in between where you don't know. So in an open world, you could have a three-valued logic where there's a middle value of open world. But in any case, the procedure for testing a constraint or a query against it is the same as isomorphic to Tarski. Now, the point that I make is that for doing this kind of analysis, first-order logic is highly efficient. And if you really want to do ontology, you really have to deal with your databases, because the databases store the overwhelming amount of data that we've got in the world, and it doesn't matter whether you've got a relational database, a high network on the web, or a network in your object-oriented databases, they're all logically equivalent. Any data you represent in one can be mapped to the other, and the only differences in them is the convenience in programming or the speed and efficiency of using one or another for different types of problems. So the point that I make is that first-order logic is a very important part of your ontologies. You must be able to represent that, and I'm very disappointed that the semantic web people have been ignoring it, because they really have to integrate all these methods of representation and reasoning.
John, so I'm aware. So I'm sympathetic to your position that first order logic gets neglected. I mean, I'm a first order chauvinist myself.
Excellent.
So but I think you're kind of overstating the case a little bit, because all the stuff that we do, you actually do theorem proving with the first order sentences. You're rarely doing, I mean, model verification does come up, but I mean, you're usually doing inference. And even if you're doing interoperability, you actually do have to be able to, you know, show that the axioms of the one ontology together with the mapping axioms entail the axioms of the other ontology.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's still theorem proving. It's not model checking.
There's a lot of that too. I do want to say that I don't want to say that deduction is not important. Deduction is important. So is induction, so is abduction, so is model checking. But the point that I did want to make is that for evaluating, just for this particular point, that model checking is the basic mechanism used for query, answering a query or answering a constraint checking. Although you
as answering a database query. There are a lot of other queries that really need to have other axioms in order to entail the query.
Indeed. Okay. And in fact, that is one of the things about deductive databases, and a lot of people will have all your ground level data in your tables, and then they will have something like Prolog or Datalog so that you can represent rule-based queries in addition to the data, so you want to do some inferences on it beyond that. I certainly agree. I'm a Prolog guy from way back. I really love Prolog. So I certainly do not want to dismiss the importance of doing the deduction. But I do want to say that first-order logic can also be used for model checking. And in fact, if you just look at the number of inferences, a number of checks per second, the model checking probably overwhelms the number of deductions in all the computers of the world. But that's another point. So, in any case, the point is that you can use a consistency checking to verify that a model, that an ontology is consistent. If you take a particular theory and you want to determine whether or not it's consistent, one way to do that is to find a model for which it's true. Unfortunately, the task of finding a model, if all you're given is a theory and somebody asks you to find a model for which this theory is true, the task of finding that model is just as difficult as theorem proving. So that finding a model can be undecidable or take exponential time in the same way that a theorem proving can be undecidable or take exponential time. Now, some cases, a lot of very important cases, in fact, the model checking can be done very efficiently, and that is one common procedure that is used. On the other hand, the general case can be difficult. But the other point that I make is that when people develop a theory of anything, they usually start with the subject matter that they're going to develop a theory about first. I mean, when Galileo started dropping things off the Tower of Pisa, he had a few objects that he was dropping, and he would drop them and he would check the time. So he gathered data. He had a lot of data about that before he formulated his theory. And then Newton also had Galileo's examples. He also had Kepler's examples and a lot of other things. So he had a lot of examples of the subject matter. And so when he developed his theory, all you need is one example to verify that your theory is correct. And if you want a simple way to do that, take your example and take the description of all the data about that example and represent it in a relational database. You can take every axiom of your theory and translate that into an SQL query, and then just verify whether each of these queries happens to be true about your model. And if you do that, you know that your theory is consistent. So this is something that I think is a requirement that we should have for theories, and we can easily provide tools. In fact, we can just use off-the-shelf database technology in order to develop these tools. Yes, Robbie.
Is just one example enough, or you need a set of consequences of your theory and model for you to see that it is fully consistent?
It's possible that if you have just one tiny example, there may be axioms in your theory that that are missed. There may be some axioms in your theory that aren't actually applicable to that particular example. So if you have more than one example, it's helpful. So the more examples you have, the more thoroughly you can do your test. But if you have a whole bunch of axioms and every one of those axioms is used, applied to a particular case, and they all turn out to be true of that thing, then you know that at least there exists one model for that theory, therefore the theory is consistent. And of course, if you have more, that helps.
Again, John, I think you're overstating the case. You know, I'm completely sympathetic, but you know, first of all, you will have theories that have only infinite models.
That is also true.
And then another point, though, is consistency isn't enough, because you can have, maybe that's your little second point to answer to Robbie, but there can be accidental truths in a particular example. So if you're building a computer vision ontology, and your example happens to be a perfect image, which is inconsistent, which works for that image, but is, say, inconsistent with any kind of noise.
Right.
Well, then you're going to say, well, my ontology, yes, it's consistent, but it's going to be completely unusable for a real example. So I'm just saying that consistency is not going to be enough.
Consistency is important, but it's not enough.
Yeah.
And so I certainly agree with those qualifications. And so that you really, want to check whether all the queries are true of the given database. And so point four is, if that passes, that means that the theory is both consistent and true of that example. It doesn't mean that it's going to be true for any other examples, so it would be very helpful to have more examples just to verify that it's not only consistent, but it's true of a broad range of examples.
Right, and I think another thing, too, is that building big on general ontologies is kind of like when you're solving a Sudoku puzzle. I mean, I know when I'm writing it, playing with it on the subway, I know that it's consistent. I know there's a solution.
Yes.
Finding that solution is the more difficult thing to do.
You know that because you know that somebody had a solution to it, you can take shortcuts that you wouldn't be able to take if you didn't know whether a solution existed. So yeah, that is, there are a lot of issues like that.
I just want to, I think, reinforce the same statement. You can come up with trivial examples, trivial models, which show consistency, but you don't want, consistency is not really what you want. You want consistency under the right circumstances. So, for example, if it falls out that half of your classes are empty, because of the particular model that you chose, but the intended interpretation is that all of these classes are not empty, because otherwise you wouldn't have them in there, then you still have formal consistency proof, but it's so far away from the intended interpretation that you don't really, doesn't help you anything.
Right.
So finding an interesting example or interesting model which shows consistency is much harder than just showing consistency.
Right. But see, the point that I'm making is that anybody that is coming up with an ontology for some subject matter started with an interesting example.
That's true.
So that if you are a physicist that's trying to develop a theory of solid-state physics, you probably already have in mind a particular model of in your mental model of how these things work, and then you take that mental model and you translate it to a bunch of mathematical equations, and then you want to just check to make sure that those equations do happen to be true of that model you started with. So that's the way people actually develop. If you look at the way scientists and engineers work, they have interesting examples in mind. They really want to build a bridge across the Verrazano Narrows, and they know that there are some very serious issues involved in building that bridge, and they will have models for that. So, as Ravi was pointed out, you probably want to have more than one model because you want to make sure that it's not only consistent, but it's also true of multiple interesting examples. So, yes. But the point I just wanted to make about this is that consistency checks, in general, are undecidable. But for the kinds of things you're really interested in, for your practical things, you probably finite models are the ones you're really interested in. But it is, as Michael was pointing out, if you've got an infinite, you're trying to prove things about the integers where you've got infinitely many, and you want to prove Fermat's last theorem, it's going to take you a lot of effort to do so because you can't just put all of your integers in the table and check.
I mean, every time ontology,
yes,
and the catalog of temporal theories is an infinite set. Yes. So you don't have to do Fermat's last theorem. I mean,
right, there's a
lot closer to home than that.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
If you include the axiom that every human has a father and a mother, and probably it's going to be false. I mean, and biologically it's false, but people assert these kinds of axioms all the time. And that's another, this additional other stuff which, has no cycles there. You are infinite.
Right. You will not be able to have a database that goes all the way back to Adam and Eve. And if you did go back that far, then you would start to worry about what happened before that. And in any case, yes.
Please repeat the question.
Right now we're just talking about a mathematical issue, but that model could come from anywhere.
The model that you have built to check the consistency, is it from endophysics or exophysics or the interface?
Okay. The point is that this is a mathematical point. This is a mathematical issue, so it doesn't really matter where that model came from. It could be a model that represents just people and things that in your ordinary world. It's an ordinary common sense model, or it could be an abstruse model that's talking about quarks and galaxies and things like that. Yes.
How do you deal with the fact that the same model can, or the same ontology could represent multiple different models? Because if you think most mathematical theories generally start by proving that they're isomorphic to something known, and therefore we've already finished. And conversely, one often uses the same structure of information to represent multiple things with quite different models.
Well, this is one of the issues that comes into this thing about the world as interface, that the point is that the phenomena that people see can be interpreted in an open-ended number of ways. So every human being has a unique personal view of the world. A lot of them may share an awful lot, but there's probably no people who have identical views of the world. And then all these theories of physics that are out there, like Newtonian mechanics and quantum mechanics and relativity, each of them is an approximation, but they have a lot in common that they say, these things may have multiple models. And in fact, in most cases, you do want to have multiple models. You want to have theories that apply not just to the current world at this instant of time, but to the future, the world, and maybe to other planets. So the fact that there's multiple models for things that you about the universe is probably good, because you really do want to talk about, you don't want to prove. Mathematicians will often try to say this theory has a unique model, but that's talking only about these highly abstract things in mathematics. In the world, we're talking about societies, and we want a theory that applies not just to a particular example. We'd like to have it apply to all the societies. So we're getting into a lot of issues here.
If I could just address that point, because I think that's actually a strength of the underlying methodology for this, because one of the ways you actually prove, you characterize all possible models of your particular ontology is by interpreting it in terms of another class of mathematical theories that is well understood. So the time ontologies, you can characterize, you can prove your time ontologies are consistent, and you can characterize all possible models of your time ontology axioms by proving that it's in fact equivalent to linear orderings. And the mathematicians have characterized all the linear orderings. They've done the work for us. And so we've done that kind of reduction there. And so, in fact, that's one of the aspects of ontology reusability is when there are multiple theories that actually do have isomorphic models. And the other point is that people get obsessed with arithmetic, which they feel has a unique model. But, in fact, the most useful mathematical theories are like groups and things like that, which have many, many more models.
And we're talking about first order logic theories here. There is no single model. For anyway, I mean, it's a logical fact that any first order logic theory you can give has more than one model, actually infinitely many models.
So, in the context of the slide, the implication of the question is that you must also verify that the model you're checking against is actually the model you think it is, because if you check against something which is actually, you think is equivalent, it may not actually be the case.
But you actually can prove that, right? So that if you have your, and I'm using the time ontologies because they're very widely used, that if you believe the mathematicians have characterized all the different possible linear orderings, then, and you say, I have my time ontology which has this before relation. If I then say, okay, this before relation is now going to be equivalent to what the mathematicians call less than, then all I have to do is give it to a theorem prover, and if I can deduce from my time ontology axioms and that mapping axiom all the linear order axioms, then I'm shown, and then vice versa, I've shown that the time ontology models are equivalent to the linear ordering models, and we're done. Right? So it's kind of this, we build this edifice. First we believe that the mathematicians have done their jobs, and then we slowly scaffold up all of our ontologies on top of that. The bulk of linear ordering of time ontologies are linear ordering, but there are branching time ontologies as well, right? Now, you'd have to go to semi-linear orderings for that. But again, you know, mathematicians have done their job. We hope.
Now, I'm going to talk about lattices, and for those people who don't know what a lattice is, it looks like something. If you draw a diagram, it looks something like the kind of lattice that you would grow rose bushes on or something like that. And a lattice should be distinguished from a tree. A tree has, for any two nodes of a tree, there is a unique parent or grandparent somewhere up above it. For any two nodes on the lattice, there may be multiple common parents or multiple nodes up above it where you can find a commonality. And usually, and for 1.4 a lattice is that for any two given nodes, there is a unique supremum, that is the lowest common parent, and a unique infimum, that is the highest common thing underneath it. And so a lattice is sort of like a tree from both ends. And if you use it, you can use it for representing multiple inheritance. Now, a lot of people that talk about programming languages that have inheritance, they say multiple inheritance is bad because you can get inconsistencies. But the answer is that is true if you don't, if you have the programmer defining those paths. What is much better is to have the system discover the paths. So instead of having somebody define the paths, what you should have is a system that that discovers what the multiple paths are, and it only discovers those paths that are consistent. So the example of the kind of software that you can have for lattices, there's a system called a theory called formal concept analysis, which has a lot of software that goes with it, and the software will take a set of concepts and attributes that define those concepts, and it will automatically generate the lattice, the smallest lattice that will represent those concepts. And so here's a table that happened to be represent beverages, and there's an example where you get that multiple inheritance not by having anybody define it, but by having the system generate it. Okay, your question. Okay. Okay. Yes. All right. So you can have the system generate it. All right. Now, I'm not going to talk about these kinds of lattices. What I do want to talk about are lattices of theories where each node happens to be a complete theory. And the person who first defined these things was Adolf Lindenbaum back in the 1930s. And it's a very useful concept. It's a very simple concept in the sense that if you have any given logic, for the time being, I'll just talk about classical sort of logics like first-order logic, or you could have any sub-logic of first-order logic, and you take that logic and then consider all theories defined in that logic, you get a lattice out of it. The top of the lattice is a theory that consists of tautologies. A tautology is a statement that is true of anything and says nothing. An example of a tautology is P implies P. For any P, any proposition P implies itself. That is a tautology. It's true for any proposition, and it says absolutely nothing. Another example is P and P implies P, or P and P implies P or P, or P and P implies P or P and P or P, and so on, and all that kind of stuff. All these kind of trivial kinds of things that say nothing are at the top of your lattice. It's a theory that has all tautologies, says nothing, and is true of everything. Now, underneath that, when you start adding axioms, you get more specialized theories, and there's a whole set of a whole sub-business talking about belief revision and theory revision methods, and they talk about methods for revising theories to get other theories that are similar in different ways. And the axioms for theory revision deal with two basic kinds of operations, contraction and expansion. If you contract a theory, you delete some axioms, and what you get is a more generalized theory. If you delete all of the axioms, you get the top of the lattice, which has no axioms at all, and you get all tautologies in it. If you add axioms, you expand the theory, and you specialize it. So deleting axioms gets more general. Adding axioms gets more specialized. And then a revision step is a contraction followed by an expansion. Like going from A to B is contraction, B to C is expansion. Or you can go directly from A to Z by a revision step. And so those are the basic methods that you do. And by adding and deleting axioms, you have an infinite lattice of all possible theories. You can go from any node to any other one just by adding and deleting axioms. But sometimes you can make a jump across the lattice from one point to another node very far away just by taking any given theory, and taking the names, crossing out the old names, and replacing them with new names that don't occur in the theory. And that gives you another theory which is isomorphic to the original theory but talks about a different subject. And the example that everybody gives is Bohr's discovery, or Bohr's model of the hydrogen atom. Niels Bohr, back in the 1910s and 20s, people had discovered electrons, and they had knew that there were these positive nucleus or positive stuff in your atom, and then there were these negative electrons that were somehow involved in that atom. And the question was, how are these electrons combined with that other stuff? And so one of the models was the plum pudding model, that the electrons are somehow embedded in a plum pudding, like raisins in a plum pudding. And another one was the idea that the electrons were somehow orbiting around the nucleus. Well, the idea of the orbiting one, that was Niels Bohr's model. And if you say that step A corresponds to Niels Bohr's original model of saying that the hydrogen atom is similar to the Earth revolving around the Sun. So theory A would be a theory about the Earth and the Sun with a gravitational attraction, which is an N-squared law, attracting them. Now, what Bohr would do is get a theory about this, where one step he might have is to go from Earth revolving around the sun. Now, by contracting that, he could take away the theory of gravity and replace that and expand it with the theory of electrical attraction. And so that would be contracting it by throwing out gravity and expanding it by throwing in electrical attraction. So that would be a step that goes from A to B to C. And then the next step would be relabeling. So he would take the theory about Earth and relabel the Earth as an electron. Then the sun he would relabel as proton. And that would jump from C to E. So he started with the labels and changed the label from Earth and sun. He relabeled it to make it electron and proton. Then what he would have to do is another revision step where he would add axioms for quantization, and then that would give him the theory of the hydrogen atom, which starts with the theory about the sun and the Earth and then gets to a theory about the electron and the proton. Yes.
John, are your labels part of your logic?
The labels are part of your ontology, so that if you have an ontology and you would have labels for the names of the things in that, for the individuals in your theory, you would also have names for the types of things in your theory, names for the labels for the names of relations between things. So each relation has a label. That's a word that says this is electrical attraction, or this is the an electron. So you would have labels for the things in your types and relations, and you just erase the old name and replace it with a new name. So we would relate gravitation and replace it with electrical attraction. So that's what relabeling does. Changes one theory about electrical gravitation into another theory about electrical attraction, and you have the same n-squared law, but you have a totally different subject.
Well, that's fine, but are you talking here in this slide about theories based on ontologies or a theories of a logic?
This is just theories of any kind. Any theory, assuming the theories are expressed in some kind of logical notation. That logical notation may include among the relations, it may include mathematical relations like addition and subtraction and multiplication. And our theories, every theory is stated in some logic. An ontology is basically a theory. So I'm saying that all of your ontology is either one single unified theory or it's a collection of theories. And so those are our things we're talking about.
John, if we carry this analogy further, more than quantization axiom, you need to introduce now some ideas that will give you nuclear forces and another axiom which will give you quarks and gluons. So more and more differentiation. You took the analogy from gravity, but that's where it stops.
Okay. I was just taking one very simple theory. This was what Niels Bohr did back in the 1920s. And what he did was just create a very simple model for the hydrogen atom. In those days, people had no concept of quarks and gluons. All they had were protons and electrons. They didn't even have a positron until Dirac came around in 1931, and people didn't believe him even then. So the point is that just a very simple theory. Now, once you've got a simple theory, you can start by expansion, expand it into more and more things. You can put that in later. Okay, so this is really the point that I'm saying is that we can relate our theories by organizing them in a hierarchy of generalization and specialization, and we can have these operators for relating them to one another. And the methods of operators that we can use for processing our theories include various kinds of things, such as a combining operation. So, for example, we have the theory A, and by expansion, we add axioms and we get down to the theory D. Now, we could also go from the theory C, and by expansion, we could also go down to the theory D. So from A, we could expand to D, or if we already had a theory C, we could expand that and go down to D. And that theory B is a combination of the theories A and C. So we have operators not only for moving from one theory to a neighbor theory, but also we can have axioms, we can have operations of taking an entire theory with all of the axioms in those theories and then merging them to another theory. Now the point is, if there is a common, if those theories have a common intersection, a common consistent intersection, then we can do that. Now the question then comes up and says, well, how do you know that the combination of those theories is going to be consistent? Well, one way that you can check is by our good old friend, the consistency check. And remember back here, if we look back to this theory over here, where did we get that consistency check? Yes. So if we have a model for a theory, we can just describe that model in a relational database and we can use SQL test to check to see if it's consistent. Now, suppose we want to have two theories and we want to know whether those two theories are consistent. Well, that can be a very difficult thing to prove in some in general. But if we're very, very lucky, we might be able to discover a model. And sometimes people will say, well, you know, the reason why we want to combine our theory of the hydrogen atom with the theories of quarks and gluons is because we want to have a unified model that talks about all of them. Well, can we do that? And the answer is, well, if you're a physicist, you probably have been thinking about quarks and gluons and all those things for a long time. So you probably have a theory in mind already. And if you want to know whether the combined theory is consistent, why don't you just create a model of your thing and then test out that model against your combined theory. Now, probably those theories are going to use a lot of differential equations and other things for which SQL is not well suited. So you can't test all theories just by putting them into a relational database, especially if you get continuous things with differential equations and all that kind of stuff. But again, the methods of testing theories does apply that if you have a model, and you can verify that every axiom in the model is true of that theory, then that means that you can combine those theories, and if you can find a common model, you can combine it. However, I do want to say that finding a model for an arbitrary combination is, in general, not a trivial task. So we can't guarantee that we can always be able to be sure. So the lattice of theories shows all of the possible interrelations. But computing all of those possible interrelations is not necessarily going to be easy to do. In a lot of cases, it can be done automatically. We would like to automate as much as we can, but I don't want to say it can all be done automatically. And the point about combining multiple incompatible theories, this is a discussion that Pat Hayes responded to something I said briefly on about four-dimensional and three-dimensional ontologies, and these bring in a lot of different incompatible ways of looking at things. And the point that we make is that different versions of exophysics may use incompatible ontologies. Now, ordinary human beings who have never been exposed to a mathematician or a physicist will almost never think in four-dimensional terms. And in fact, when people first started talking about four-dimensional ontologies, everybody said they were crazy. And there's one of my favorite philosophers is Charles Sanders Peirce, and his father, Benjamin Peirce, was a famous mathematician in America. And there was a comment by somebody who attended one of these lectures and said, both of these Peirces are sometimes mad. They were talking about four dimensions and saying that the world has four dimensions, and everybody knows that is crazy, but they go and say these crazy things, and I would not recommend that. And so people don't normally think in those terms. On the other hand, as Matthew West and others have been saying, it's very useful for a lot of things that we want to represent. And here's an example of a three-dimensional way of talking. We can say a person is born at a time t1, a person dies at a time t2, and for any time between T1 and T2, the person is alive at some location X, three-dimensional X, and has attributes that may change from time to time. A four-dimensional way of looking at things says that a person corresponds to a 4D volume. Now, normal people don't think in terms of 4D volumes, and the times T1 and T2 are the lower and upper bounds of the time coordinates of that volume, and some attributes of the person may be true or false at different points in that volume. These are two different ways of talking about things. But the point that I was making and that was arguing with Pat about was that if you want to reconcile these different theories, any theory that has any claim to be true about the world must be related some way to the phenomena, observable phenomena. And if we restrict ourselves to a way of talking that is with a very trivial ontology that is limited only to those observable things, we can, in that case, then have a theory, a very simple theory, that is consistent and allows us to share data about those things. And the example that I was talking about is frogs and tadpoles and an individual named Kermit, and how one might represent Kermit as an egg at one point and at one time, and a tadpole at another time, and a frog at another time. And the point is that those different theories may use terms and variables that are not directly related to observation. Like Matthew frequently talks about these four-dimensional volumes that nobody can ever really visualize or experience. However, they're convenient. And the point that I make is that any conclusions that Matthew might derive from his four-dimensional ontology and someone else might derive from a three-dimensional ontology must be statable in that phenomenological the terms if you want to be able to share data. Yes?
I don't understand why would that be an example for inconsistent theories. I mean, the of course, four-dimensionalism comes in different flavors, but if I assume the one that Matthew was talking about is where basically stages of the four-dimensional worms are that what we, a normal three-dimensionalist, would call the entities, then it's a trivial translation from one language to the other. Well, okay, the experts in that field will point at very weird circumstances, like when relativity theory goes wrong, or you know, things like that happen, where there might be a difference between the translation breaks down. But in every normal circumstance, you can just translate what a four-dimensionalist says trivially what a three-dimensionalist would say, and vice versa. So it doesn't seem to be really an inconsistent theory, because as long as you do the translation correctly, they will agree with each other.
That is true. If you're talking only about the geometry, a four-dimensional theory can break down into a 3+1-dimensional version where you talk about a time slice at each instant of time. And so, indeed, you can relate all the geometrical properties of one theory to another. The question that comes up that people get hung up about are the nature of what is the nature of an individual, and whether, and you get to these temporal mereology theories where you talk about entities that have temporal parts, and you talk about continuance and occurrence, and translating a definition of what is a continuant and what is a temporal part in in a four-dimensional version to a three-dimensional version.
But it's a purely ideological debate, and with no consequences whatsoever, since you can't intertranslate except for very rare circumstances. If from a practical point, if you look at any application, the queries you get the answers you get to your queries will be exactly the same regardless.
I agree, and however, there are these points that the people that are talking, they're saying that when you get to those theoretical, as you said, ideological terms, those are things that are theoretical terms that are not, that are only indirectly related to the phenomenological language. If you restrict yourself only to the language of observables, you can relate the two, and that's the point I was making. But if you get into the theoretical terms, you'll find that theoretical terms in one field don't have a smooth translation to the other. And but if you make any predictions that can be observed, then those predictions are going to be consistent. So that's what I agree with.
So John,
yes,
so John, when you talk about continuous,
I was trying to say that direct consequence of 4D observation of the life example that you gave on previous slide is that ontology is true, which would predict the true trajectory in four dimensions that that person followed. Was that person at a given time and given location in 3DX sense, and that consequence, that consistency would prove which ontology is more pertinent to that 4D person example?
They should be, as far as the observable facts, they should be equivalent. So that's the point that we should... Yeah.
The person was not everywhere in 4D space. He or she was only on a trajectory of space and time. And that trajectory is a true trajectory for which that ontology would apply as a consequence.
John, I wanted to ask a quick question.
Let's queue everyone up. It's Mike Bennett, and then Pat Hazardy, and Simon Sparrow.
Okay, fine. So, Peter, why don't you control the questions, because there's too many right now to deal with. Okay, so who's first? Mike?
Yeah, Mike, go ahead.
Okay, thanks, Peter. Very quick question. John, when you talk about continuum, so when I first looked at your lattice work, and to me, as somebody who thinks in four dimensions anyway, I have a instinctive understanding of a continuum as something which has some being over time. And it wasn't until I dropped that word continuum into conversations with some of these evangelists or geeks or whatever of one ideological side or another that I discovered that somebody else out there has some very distinct and three-dimensional definition of continuum. So when you say continuum, are you happy that, you know, the common sense, the interface usage of continuum is one that we could use that word across both dimensionalities and ignore the confusion?
Okay. Well, my answer to that is that I wouldn't use the word continuum in talking to somebody who's just observing data. When you observe data, all you observe is the frog named Kermit happened to be located at this point in time, later the tadpole, or some earlier time, a tadpole with the same name Kermit happened to be located at a different point. And normal people don't talk about continuance and occurrence. All they talk about is, hey, I saw a frog. And that's the only thing that you have to talk about at the phenomenological level. And if you avoid talking about these theory-laden terms, you can reach some sort of agreement. Yes.
Yeah, I think that the inconsistency comes in that these are inconsistent models. So the endurantist says the 3D objects exist and 4Ds don't, and the perturbantist says the 4D objects exist and 3Ds don't. These assertions are truly logically incompatible. But when you have any observation or any assertion about these objects, like Fabian says, and you say, and I agree, and even Pat Hayes agrees, I think even Matthew agrees, they're absolutely translatable into each other, accurately. So there's no problem. It's just there are different models, fine. You isolate them in sequestered theories that have no relationship to anything else in the world.
Right. And that's the point that I was making. We need some criterion for determining what kinds of statements will be translatable and what kinds of statements will not be translatable. And the point is that if you restrict yourself to the observation statements, you can translate those. But there may be these abstruse, esoteric, theoretical terms that are not going to be translatable. Don't even try.
I was just about literally to see what the average velocity in time and space of a volume of quine was, and whether on impact with the metaspace it would break into parts, both temporal and connected. But it seems like we're rehashing 1960 onwards, and that as long as the data agrees, it's best just to completely ignore and forget how much time we spent learning all this stuff. Just concentrate on the stuff that is actually showing up in the data sets that we need to work with, and concentrate on the stuff that we can actually complete in the time frame before it becomes obsolete. It seems like we're going down a gather guy hole.
Michael?
So I think the reason why this 3D, 4D kind of debate kind of just drags on and on and on is the fact that people don't actually put their money where their mouth is and actually provide axioms. A fixed, finite set of axioms for 3D and a fixed, finite set for a 4D ontology, because I've never seen one. No one ever provides them. The closest they get is having some pseudo English stuff like you had on your earlier slide. If you actually go to other examples where there are real axioms, it's exactly what Fabian said, that these theories are usually intertranslatable. So, just coming back to the time example, there are linear theories of time where there are only time points. Time intervals do not exist. There are others that only intervals exist. Time points do not exist. And it's analogous to this case here. But because people actually wrote the axioms down, you can actually prove that these are intertranslatable. It's just that what happens is when you're doing the mapping, you actually end up, say, from the time interval perspective, you take a whole equivalence class of intervals, and that is mapped to a point. And vice the other way around, a pair of points is mapped to an interval. Right? But again, it's only when you write the axioms down. And then my other favorite example is geometry. So Hilbert's geometry with points, lines, and planes as primitives, and Tarski's geometry with only points. Planes don't exist, lines don't exist. Those are also intertranslatable. Somebody could say, in the time example, no, time intervals do not exist. Only time points do, or the other way around, because maybe time points with this point in time doesn't really mean anything. Only intervals exist, no matter how small they get. These are just empty philosophical debates. It's when you get the axioms down, that's when we have to worry. I agree with you on that point. That it's the axioms that are what we're into delivering here.
Okay. All right. I had a question. I think it relates to some of the things that were in the latest forum discussions. In discussing the frog named Kermit and the tadpole named Kermit, you equated the two, that there's essentially there's an endurance between the tadpole to the frog. Now, you did that quickly in passing, but that was raised as an issue, I think.
Actually, in my and the little example that I wrote to in response to Pat Hayes on the internet, I said that I'll assume that some observers have some way of recognizing this. I will pass over the question of how they recognize that it's the same Kermit, and maybe they put a band on his leg or something like that, or they checked his DNA. I have no idea, or they kept him in a particular aquarium, so there's no other frogs to check, so that they knew that it was the only one. I have no idea. But in any case, I just wanted to say that that is a very important issue in philosophy of science and measurement and everything else, but we don't want to talk about them right now.
I think there is a way of axiomatizing those relationships among the endurances that appear at different times. I don't recall ever having seen it done. But I think I could probably do it. I've done part of it, if you really want it. But we rely on intuition, as John says in this case. We rely more on recognizing the same individual. And we know from hypothetical cases like the ship of Theseus, where every part at some point or another was replaced, every single part, is it still the same ship? And the answer is yes. Just you just have to have a criterion for a diachronic identity, that's all.
The main point I wanted to make about this is that a lot of interoperability has succeeded where people just pass information about names and dates and places, and people have succeeded. And I just wanted to explain why they have that success. And the reason they have that success is that they are interchanging observation data, which is relatively theory independent. It's information about that interface, and there can be all kinds of esoteric theories about what is an individual and all those kinds of things, but those esoteric theories really don't affect your observables. So for an awful lot of very practical issues, we can indeed interchange data at the observation level. On the other hand, if you are going to interchange data about these esoteric exophysics and endophysics theories, that is where you are likely to create problems and find that your things are not going to be intertranslatable or the translations are going to be very difficult. And that example of Tarski's spheres, Tarski had a theory in which the only primitive was a sphere, and a point was defined as a limiting case of a descending set of spheres. So there was actually no single point there, but it was a limiting case, and so he was mapping the limiting case in one theory to an actual primitive in the other theory, and you're going to get all kinds of problems like that of what does it mean, and we don't want to solve all those in the next 30 seconds.
Excuse me, Dr. So, I had a quick observation. This is Teresa.
Can you hang on just one moment, please?
Okay, so let's answer the question.
So that's a hard stop at 5:30, Afidra. Please go ahead.
Okay, for interoperability in enterprise architecture, we do data architecture and we do data elements, description of each data element. Data dictionary and a data element, description of that. So any system that accesses that particular data element is accessed the same way because the description has been and the way the format, everything is described the same way throughout. That helps with interoperability and to maintain the data in a clean way. In ontological world, can't we use the same concept?
Okay, is there a question there or just a statement?
Clarification, because we were discussing about interoperability for using ontologies. If you use ontologies,
okay.
If you develop ontologies, and for semantic web, we would think about interoperability. But that's how interoperability is used. That's an approach for interoperability within an organization if we use enterprise architecture concepts. Some of the same things be used looking at actual data elements rather than whole set of ontology and think about interoperability because in enterprise architecture world it's a bottom up approach for interoperability.
Okay.
To obtain interoperability.
Yes. Well, even in the enterprise world, you do get a lot of cases where the data formats might be very well defined, but the definition of how those things relate to the world can be very different. So one example is an oil company where they had a geological database and a financial database that had different definitions of oil well. And so in the geological database, an oil well was defined as any hole in the ground that was drilled or dug for the purpose of getting oil, even those holes that happen to be, turn out to be dry holes. And in the financial database, an oil well was any pipe that was connected to one or more holes in the ground for producing oil. So that you could actually have multiple holes connected to the same pipe. Now, what they then wanted to do is to take the data from the financial database and the geological database and relate them so that they could correlate the rock studies and the geological studies to the amount of production that they got, and they discovered that they couldn't do a nice, clean one-to-one mapping of oil wells because they had two totally different definitions. So this is the kind of thing that comes up all the time. And there's another example of a copper mine where they had the field in their employee database where they had the sex field. They had three values because it turned out that when they had were digging the bringing the ore out of the ground, they used mules to pull the trains because they did not want to have any engines that might create sparks. So they had mules that would pull the engines out of the ground, and then they assigned employee numbers to their mules. And so then when they transferred their data to punch cards, they had a field there, so they had a code there that was either male, female, or mule. And so there you have an ontology that's a very strange kind of ontology, and things like that occur constantly in every enterprise, and that's the problems that we get.
Yes. You have 1.5 slides left.
No, actually, I'm really not finished. There's only the last. This is the last slide.
And since Pat and Michael is here, and of course you're here, I would love to maybe devote some time to talking about, let's say, the work in relation to foundational ontology and
yes.
open ontology repository. So please save some time for that.
Right. I think this is very important. And the point that this is the last slide. The only thing that follows this is just some readings, and you can do that at your own leisure. The hierarchy of, I use the term the hierarchy of ontologies as a subset of those that were implemented, and I decided to add a new adjective there, the hierarchy of certified ontologies. So the idea is that this infinite lattice of all possible theories is something that's never going to be implemented. But what we can do is to take the ones that we started with, and I was mentioning the Colore examples that Michael was discussing, and the idea is that we want to take those starting sets and start relating them to one another so that the hierarchy is a finite subset. The theories in the hierarchies are ones that somebody has certified as being consistent and used successfully in one or more applications. So as a minimal requirement, I think we should have some consistency test. And as I said, one such test could be done by just testing your axioms against a database. But there are a lot of other studies that could be made, and there are other ways of showing consistency that we would like to have. And before accepting something into the hierarchy, we should at least say, have you proved that it's consistent? And also, have you used it for one or more successful applications that somebody actually paid to have done? Because there's a lot of hypothetical things that people have put together that they've never tested, and we really should try things that actually have been used. Now, there's a lot of... Now, the other point that I make is that the hierarchy is a subset, so that it may not have all of the links of the infinite lattice. It only has those that somebody has actually discovered, and that there may be some links that have not yet been discovered. So the hierarchy won't be a lattice to begin with. It will be a partial ordering, but there may be unknown links between them. And the ones that we have are the ones that are known to be true, but as people discover more information, they may add more information to the lattice. So there's a lot of space on that slide which people can add more information to. Yes.
Maybe not so much a comment on this, although I do see you sort of grounding the ontologies through applicable, applying them somewhere. But part of what I saw in your presentation on the forum as well as here was the idea of formalizing observation, a very simple formalization of observation.
Well, I would say that if you have an ontology that covers that subject matter, it would cover the observations as well.
Yeah.
It would apply to the observations.
One of the things I noticed what seems to be absent in your very simple model for observation, which relates to a database very nicely, that's consistent with what you're pushing or stressing. But what was missing in that model of observation was the pragmatic part, the purposes of the observation,
yes.
and so forth, which is a larger thing. When you introduce that, it gets a little bit more complicated, I think.
There's a lot of issues that are very complicated, including the parts that Corey mentioned right at the beginning, where we talk about meta-levels and modeling methods and the methodologies for how do we do all this? How do we... this is one of the things that Corey represents the OMG, which has had a long history of worrying about those issues. And in fact, one of the things that I was concerned about is that the semantic web was done in isolation from so many of the other more traditional techniques that have been done. Now, I can understand that people would say, well, the OMG has this huge amount of stuff and we don't want to swallow all of that to begin with. And I'm sympathetic to that too, but the point is that there should be bridges among these things. And one thing that I think is very important is that people have started to take UML and translate that into common logic, to have a foundation for mapping UML to common logic. And I think that can be a foundation that we should build on for relating everything else. Yes, Jim.
One comment is that what we have reality, and to go with this reality, we have language and mathematical symbolisms that are analogs to describing this reality. And analogies are never reality. Analogs never represent the total reality exactly. They are just that. They're analogs. And when we're talking about the total holistic reality, it's very difficult to impossible to come up with an analogy which is totally accurate. And this is true in all kinds of modeling, where you're making approximations that cut off certain variables, and it's true with linguistics as well. And so it helps to keep in mind that analogies are not reality. That was the only point I was going to make.
Okay. I think there's a lot of issues like that we should be continuing, but we have to wrap it up now. So are there any further questions from people online or here that pressing issues people want to bring up?
I'm just unclear about who's going to maintain this hierarchy and who's going to develop all the ontologies in the hierarchy. You know, it's hard enough to get... If you have n hierarchies at kind of the bottom level of a lattice, and you'd have like n squared in the whole lattice, who's going to develop and maintain all those theories?
That's an excellent question. And one possibility would be if we provided something and provided a home for it, we might be able to take advantage of the kinds of things that people have done with Wikipedia and other sorts of things where we would have volunteers. But as we can see with SourceForge, just putting something out there doesn't necessarily mean that anybody is going to do anything with it. On SourceForge, there are a relatively small number of things that are extremely heavily used and an immense number of things that practically nobody uses. And I think that this is something that we should consider. Can we take this community that we have here and build on it and put together something that can attract enough volunteers as well as enough funding agencies to do something like that? That's a good question.
It's not volunteers, it's graduate students.
And I would say that's also one of the roles that OMG and organizations like OMG play, to vet and bring to consensus among a community a set of certified theories. We don't generally call them theories in OMG, we call them models, but within the domain of interest for that group, which is generally modeling architecture or processes, that type of thing, that's exactly what we do. We maintain and develop these models. Yeah. And I think it would make perfect sense to bring more of this community and that community together, which is part of what we're trying to do, is to bridge some of these communities. Which are not as separate as they may appear.
Another example is Eclipse. IBM had developed some tools for doing software development, and they could see that they were not able to compete against Microsoft Studio and some of these other things. So what they did is make it free and open source and got a whole coalition of people together. And Eclipse is now an extremely well-used and well-developed interface. So it's all open source, but they also allow people to bring into it tools that they charge money for. So that attracts vendors as well as volunteers. And there are a lot of people that are making money from Eclipse. I think we can look at that as a possible business model. So we would have a foundation that is free, so it would attract anybody. The entrance level would be free. But on the other hand, people would be able to build up things that they could charge money for so that it would attract vendors who could make a profit. So that's a possibility. Peter.
Can you suggest one small step that is actually doable within the next week?
Well, I think one thing is that that Peter, you already have a website. We could start putting things together on your website.
By all means, how, who, where?
Okay.
Well, we have so this preliminary pre-beta version of Chloray online with about 60 common logic modules, and with the New Year's resolution of each day adding something new. So by the end of March, we should have something pretty good.
Okay. Mike, are those related to each other in any way yet?
Well, we're putting, so that's the thing. So now we'll be putting the mappings in. Every day there'll be a new mapping and provable, with a little proof that the mapping's correct.
You have a graduate student doing that.
I have several graduate students doing that.
Okay. Can I propose then on the wiki, we start sort of a project, let's give it a name, and then use that as sort of the presentation page and start pointing to Chloray in the axioms that you're developing.
Right, yeah. I mean, I always thought of this as being in the larger umbrella of the Open Ontology Repository project, and then Pat Cassidy will be organizing a special content session of that in the next month. You were saying, by the end of March, but sometime in April.
That's going to have to be postponed, I think, but we'll have to see. We're sending out a letter. We'll see what the responses are.
Right.
And then subject.
Yes, I just see this as just being one kind of component.
Soon enough. But so shall we sort of label this with something? I mean, just make a name. So since you're on the podium, give us a name.
Okay, well, one possibility is just to use the title, Sharing and Integrating Ontologies. SIO.
Too long.
So we could call it the SIO.
Something that reduces to an acronym and something short enough. So, what? Shared Ontologies?
Shared Ontologies.
Integrated Ontologies?
Yeah, well, call it SIO. Shared and Integrated Ontologies. SIO.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
Integrated Ontologies
is to finish this report. I'll add, by the end of this week, I will take the report I have out there, and I'll take my slides, and I'll post both of them on my website and put them together so that that will be a report we can use, among other things. It's not going to be the final version, but it will be an interim version we can work with.